This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the US President wants Australia's help with an inquiry into the origins of the Russia investigation. And Prime Minister Scott Morrison wants to help if he can. But how should Australia be responding? And interest rates cut again. The Reserve Bank goes below 1% for the first time. But what good will it do for Australia's troubled economy?
There we are, rate cut 25 basis points.
The RBA delivered a cut today in part because growth is running below trend, inflation is below target, and the labour market needs a bit more momentum, so the local story is quite clear, but also because, of course, global interest rates have fallen to phenomenal lows.
First today, Beijing witnessed a military parade par excellence as hundreds of thousands of Chinese tuned in on TV and online to watch the much-anticipated celebration of seven decades of Communist Party rule in their country. Flawlessly coordinated oceans of people, 100,000 of them, some crisply uniformed and in perfect step, others civilian, filled the heart of Beijing, where the most powerful leader since Mao, President Xi Jinping, stood atop the Tiananmen rostrum in a Mao suit and reviewed a massive display of military hardware. To our correspondent Bill Birtles in Beijing in a moment, and expert analysis of the weapons China paraded today. That's coming up too. But first, to give you a sense of the sounds and the feel of National Day in Beijing, Isabel Rowe prepared this report.
Bayonets raised and not a hair out of place, thousands of soldiers marching in perfect formation at the beginning of the hours-long parade. 56 guns for 56 ethnic groups, each fired 70 times. Looking down on the crowd, China's most powerful president since Chairman Mao, Xi Jinping.
Today, a socialist China is standing rock firm in the east of the world. No force can shake the status of our great nation or stop the Chinese people and nation from striving forward.
President Xi then went to inspect the troops standing through the sunroof of a black limousine. He yelled, "Hello, comrades." The soldiers replying, "Follow the party." Then came the weapons in their hundreds. On China's official global television network, English-speaking commentators spruiked the country's most powerful warhead yet.
The DN-41 is an intercontinental strategic nuclear missile. Its purpose is for both balancing power and securing victory. They are deployed in the mountains and the ocean in defense of national security and world peace.
Rolling through Tiananmen Square for half an hour, drones, submersibles, tanks, equipment developed by China designed to show off its capability. Despite all of this, President Xi reiterated a message of peace.
Over the last 70 years, Chinese people of all ethnicities have been of one heart and one mind and working hard, and achieved accomplishments that have caught the attention of the world.
There was even a float representing the Uyghur minority, one of the 56 ethnic groups, despite recent attention on China's persecution of the Uyghurs. Following the display of military hardware came the People's Parade. One of the floats, a representation of one country, two systems.
The formation includes Chinese from Hong Kong, Macau and Taiwan.
The English parade commentators repeating a message crafted for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong.
The policy of one country, two systems is the cornerstone of reunification. China says the policy will succeed as long as it is fully, accurately understood.
Xi Jinping echoed those sentiments.
On our journey forward, we must adhere to the principle of peaceful reunification and one country, two systems, maintain long-term prosperity and stability of Hong Kong and Macau, push for peaceful development of cross-strait relationship, unite all Chinese people to continue to work hard for the complete reunification of our nation.
To finish, the release of 70,000 balloons and 70,000 white doves.
Isabel Rowe with that report. Well, let's go to the ABC's China correspondent, Bill Birtles. He's been among the world's media gathered in Tiananmen Square for today's events. I asked him how he saw Xi Jinping and the Communist Party portraying themselves today.
Probably one word would sum it up: strength. Xi Jinping put on a display in an attempt to show primarily the Chinese domestic audience, but also the world, that the Chinese state, 70 years into communism, under President Xi's current rule, is not just prosperous, but strong, militarily strong. We saw this array of new weaponry. The Dongfeng 41 missile was the highlight. This missile, which, if you believe the Chinese claims, is the longest range nuclear capable missile in the world. That was on display for the first time. Fighter jets up ahead. You had drones, you had all sorts of Chinese-made weaponry on display. And this, plus the 15,000 troops marching down past Tiananmen Square, conveyed this overall sense of national strength.
But also the word struggle has been used by Xi Jinping. What does he mean by struggle when clearly at the same time he's saying, look, we've arrived?
This is an old Communist Party term that's been used for a long time. Xi Jinping has revived it somewhat. He talks about struggle in all sorts of different contexts, but it basically means we're continuing to run campaigns on certain things. We haven't made it yet. And he talks often about the continuous struggle to build, let's say, a moderately prosperous society or to achieve the great rejuvenation of the Chinese state. You know, all these sorts of rhetorical things are quite lofty, but they do actually align with practical goals. And if you look at that major one, the great rejuvenation, this actually has a timeline. 2050 is when China needs to have achieved all those goals, including taking Taiwan under communist control. So in one sense, it's just rhetorical, but on the other hand, it does guide the actual long-term plans of the Communist Party. This is all about reinforcing communism, or the Communist Party, to be more precise, at the front and center of all facets of Chinese life. Because you have to remember, before Xi Jinping, there was a period there for about 10 or 20 years where it was generally felt that the ideology of communism had fallen away. Xi Jinping very much wants to make it part of his legacy that he's brought the Communist Party back.
But what about the standout challenges at this very time, particularly the protests in Hong Kong, of course, and I guess the campaign against the Uyghurs? Does that jar in any way in terms of presenting that message about the Communist Party's dominance?
Well, because Xi Jinping has complete control of both the airwaves and the internet in this country, today, for example, and in the days leading up to this military parade, it was just a sea of patriotic red reports. And so stories about the plight of the Uyghurs are not really part of that narrative. The protests in Hong Kong, I doubt they'll be getting any coverage in the state media today. And if you do look at the situation in Xinjiang province, for example, when you do read about that, either online or in the state media, it's all about Xi Jinping stressing racial unity. In fact, I'm just reading a headline from 2 days ago in front of me of the China Daily, the top story, more ethnic unity urged across the nation from Xi. So that gives you an idea of how it's all presented to a domestic audience here.
And so standing on that podium today, who did Xi Jinping surround himself with?
Well, he was surrounded by the two former presidents, his predecessors, Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin. And Jiang Zemin's very interesting. He's in his 90s now, but he's still widely believed to wield a lot of power, a lot more than Hu Jintao. And it's long been thought that Xi and Jiang have had a bit of a factional struggle between them. But there were all sorts of old veterans and people who had really had distinguished roles in the history of the Communist Party. This was very much a domestic celebration.
Our China correspondent, Bill Birtles. Well, China's military budget is second only to that of the United States. And what we saw today in Beijing was all the kinds of armoury that makes Washington very nervous. Huge nuclear nuclear, hypersonic, supersonic, and with immense strategic reach. Let's break all that down a little bit. Antoine Bondaz is a foreign and security policy researcher with the French independent think tank, the Foundation for Strategic Research. I asked him first about the single biggest weapon we saw for the first time today, the enormous Dongfeng 41.
So it's a very, very important ICBM, so an intercontinental ballistic missile. It's basically the first time that China have such a huge road mobile and solid field ICBM that could carry on up to 10 warheads, but especially carry on what we call penetration aids. The key objective for China is to make sure that they can defeat U.S. ballistic missile defense and reach actually any targets within the U.S. mainland.
Now, another first today was a hypersonic ballistic nuclear missile, the DF-17. Some say this is the one that's more of a threat to regional stability. Tell us about that and about that strategic implication.
So the DF-17 is quite important, that the first time that actually any country is displaying hypersonic technology during a military parade. So that's a first. That's an opportunity actually for China to present itself at the forefront of global innovation. What is very, very important for regional purposes is we do not know yet whether it's a nuclear capable or dual used missile, conventional and nuclear capable. What is sure for China is that they want to make sure that they can target any potential targets around China, especially potentially along Taiwan or maybe moving targets in the sea in a very short span of time.
Now, there's a lot more, of course, to China's materiel, but when you looked at that parade today, where did you see China as a fighting force, as a military power on the globe compared particularly to the United States?
I think what is very important once again, and the Chinese have warned us before, that's first the DF-41, that's Chinese nuclear deterrent, even if it's not sea-based or fully sea-based yet, is still very, very credible. The second one is everything about hypersonic vehicle, that China is innovated and innovating at the same pace as the US. And the third one, of course, is to remind everyone that the army is the army of the party and that is not the army of the country.
Is there anything else that China might be working on that we didn't see today? Of course, we didn't see cyber weapons, for example. What else would you point out?
What is very important is all the work of China in terms of cyber weapons, in terms of space weapons. And in the coming 10 to 20 years, Chinese space capacities will be something to watch because it's going to be very, very important for the US, but also for any other space power. It's important for Europe. It's going to be very important for Japan, but also for Australia, of course.
And in the post-Cold War period, we've been used to multilateral, sometimes bilateral arms control agreements, but an arms control framework to try to rein in the potential for disaster. Where does China sit on the question of arms control?
So far, China has refused to enter the arms control logic and to enter any multilateralized arms control agreements, be it the INF Treaty, be it potentially in the coming month, the New START Treaty. China considers that its arsenal is limited and that there is no reason for China to join a Russia-US arms control agreements. That's actually going to be a key question in the coming years, whether we can kind of rein in or at least make sure that Chinese ballistic, including ballistic capacities, might have actually a limit and we not further develop the same way they've developed the last 15 years.
Antoine Bondaz, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Antoine Bondaz is a foreign and security policy researcher with the French independent think tank, the Foundation for Strategic Research. Well, thousands of Hong Kong residents are thumbing their nose at the Chinese leadership, again taking to the streets in defiance of the idea that 70 years of communist rule is something to celebrate. With Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, flying to Beijing for the events, it was left to the region's acting chief executive, Matthew Chung, to speak at the local flag raising.
Hong Kong 回歸祖國22年以來，中央一直 Hong Kong has been returned to China for 22 years. Under one country, two systems, Hong Kong has relied on and benefited from China's support. Currently, an uncertain situation has occurred in Hong Kong. Some radical protesters, ongoing and escalating protests, have not just affected the social order, challenged the rule of law, but it has also affected the safety and normal life of citizens and worsened a declining economy.
So some radical protesters are to blame, according to Hong Kong's leadership. Well, they are back on the streets this afternoon, and our reporter Greg Jennett is amongst them. Greg, despite a ban on protests today in Hong Kong, people are back. What are you seeing there?
Yes, more than just a few rogue, hardcore protesters. In fact, we're seeing very few of those, Linda. We're in the central government precinct on Hong Kong Island. That's called Admiralty, and we've witnessed hundreds of thousands of people peacefully, it must be said, proceed from the Causeway Bay shopping area up to Admiralty, and still that swarm of people passes up towards the city. So we are hearing that across on the Kowloon side and in the new territories, there are much smaller gatherings of people where tear gas has been fired to disperse crowds there, but no sign of trouble here. And in fact, this scene that we're watching at the moment is exactly the same site, Linda, of very aggressive confrontations on Sunday. So a subtle difference here, no conflict with police, at least not so far.
Given what's going on in Beijing today, given the significance of this day to the Chinese Communist Party, will either the protesters or police feel somewhat constrained here?
That's a possible interpretation that could explain why things are so calm and peaceful so far. But I do believe it's early days in the evening here, Linda, because there's every possibility that what will happen tonight is what has happened on so many occasions, and that is as the sun sets and a lot of peaceful people go home, that's when trouble brews with the frontliners, as they call them, the more youthful and hardcore elements who want to make a point by attacking government buildings or a police detachment somewhere. So we can't rule that out as a possibility. But at this point, it is very risky.
And the official events commemorating the Chinese Communist Party's 70th, have they gone off without any interruptions?
Yeah, well, they were really in what Australians might call these days the bubble, Linda. They were invitation-only events inside secure government grounds where chants could be heard from the exterior walls, but there was no way for trouble to be caused at those events much earlier in the day. You've already played an excerpt from the acting chief executive, Matthew Chung, and that was so remote from the people that they probably didn't even bother viewing it on broadcast media, such as the distrust that they harbour towards the Hong Kong government. I mean, that's why they're out on the streets this afternoon.
And, of course, Xi Jinping has spoken today of peaceful reunification, one country, two systems, maintaining lasting prosperity and stability, but continuing to fight for full reunification of our motherland. It seems there's just no movement in terms of a resolution for this.
No, that's right. There's nuance in that speech. We've had some people quote to us passages of the speech that would sound placatory or conciliatory, and yet there are the bits that you've just quoted, Linda, that sound as hardline as ever when it comes to managing this area. So sure, they can say one country, two systems and let Hong Kong sort it out themselves, but that's not the way that they've operated so far. They've been unflinching in their refusal to enter negotiations on four of the five key demands here, and there's no sign that that's changing today either.
Okay, thanks very much, Greg. Greg Jennett, our reporter in Hong Kong. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, how the US-China trade war plus a sluggish Australian economy convinced the Reserve Bank today that it needed to go even lower on interest rates. Well, the news that Donald Trump asked for Australia's help to clear his name over possible election interference has some foreign affairs analysts declaring it completely inappropriate. What was revealed today is that the US president asked Scott Morrison to help provide evidence that would discredit the Mueller investigation. That was the long-running inquiry into whether the president's campaign colluded with Russia in the 2016 election campaign. Some say Australia played a straight bat diplomatically, but it's the context that matters. A US president now seen to be serially pressuring foreign countries to advance his own political agenda. Julia Holman prepared this report.
Australia is a fantastic country. Honour being with the Prime Minister.
Donald Trump gave Scott Morrison a very warm welcome when they met in Washington late last month.
You have a truly great country, and I don't think we've ever had a better relationship than we have right now.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for the opportunity for the discussions we've had today.
But just a few weeks before their face-to-face catch-up in the Oval Office, they had a phone conversation.
We have some breaking news just coming to hand.
Australia is at the centre of new allegations which are damaging US President Donald Trump.
The New York Times today broke the story that the American president asked Scott Morrison for Australia's help in finding information to discredit the Mueller investigation, which looked at possible collusion between the Trump presidential campaign and Russia. Australia's intelligence was pivotal to the Mueller probe. The FBI began examining Trump ties to Russia only after Australia's then High Commissioner to the UK, Alexander Downer, reported Russian contacts were looking to provide information to Trump advisers that could damage Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
There was a hoax that was perpetrated on our country.
The president frequently described the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt, and in May this year, Donald Trump told reporters that he wanted the role of foreign countries in the Mueller probe, including Australia, to be investigated by his Attorney General, William Barr.
I hope he looks at the UK, and I hope he looks at Australia, and I hope he looks at Ukraine. I hope he looks at everything.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, today said that Australia is happy to help.
We've said we've always been willing to cooperate and shedding light on those investigations.
The opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, wants to know exactly what the Prime Minister has promised to do.
So that it's made clear that the Australian Prime Minister is not involved in what is essentially a domestic issue in the United States.
The request by President Trump puts Australia in a tricky diplomatic situation, according to Stephen Loosley, who's a senior visiting fellow at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
The fact the President rang the Prime Minister has definitely elevated the issue. This is an unusual way to do business, and hence it is more than a little surprising.
He says Australia has to be careful when responding to the request.
Well, Australia is a responsible ally, and so playing a straight bat here is the best way forward, while being alert to the impact of the 2020 campaign. Australia certainly doesn't want to be dragged into the middle of a firefight between the Trump administration and whoever emerges as a Democratic candidate.
And Stephen Loosley says it's another example where the US president is pressuring foreign countries for his own political advantage, pointing to the news last week that the president pushed Ukraine to investigate his presidential rival, Joe Biden.
We should bear in mind that President Trump brought the attitudes of a middle-tier New York real estate developer to politics and to the White House. He's intensely transactional, and the transaction at the moment is his re-election, and everything else is going to be secondary to that in his eyes.
Professor Gordon Flake is the CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia.
This is a president that doesn't seem to have any boundaries whatsoever, and who views the distinction between government and private to be extremely blurry at best.
Is it appropriate for the president to ask an ally like Australia to provide information about such a partisan issue?
No, it's not. It's normal for the US to ask an ally like Australia to assist in an investigation. What's not normal is for the United States to ask Australia to assist in an investigation that's designed to discredit its own intelligence services, the FBI, and it's designed to prop up a conspiracy theory for political gain of the president. So it's really that complete elimination of the line between politics and policy and government propriety in that regard, and it's been broken.
Professor Gordon Flake from the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of WA. Julia Holman with that report. Well, with a shopping list of problems still dogging the Australian economy, the Reserve Bank has taken interest rates to their lowest ever level, cutting the cash rate to just 0.75 of a percentage point. Despite earlier cuts to even ever lower lows, the domestic economy is still slowing, wages remain stagnant, and there's the constant threat of a major global financial shock. But Australia's central bank is also a reluctant participant in an ongoing currency war as China and the US fight it out for advantage. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
The value of the Australian dollar is crucial to the nation's economic fortunes. Traders here at CMC Markets are on the currency front lines. Michael McCarthy, head trader.
There we are, rate cut 25 basis points. Immediate reaction to the Australian dollar, it's dropped back down towards 67.40.
Looks like it's falling off a cliff.
Well, this is a short-term chart, so it does look more dramatic, but yes.
Now, the Reserve Bank, part of the move to lower rates is to make the Australian dollar more competitive. Do you think ultimately the Reserve Bank is winning the currency war as far as it can?
While we think of the Aussie as a national scorecard, the reality is, on balance, a lower Australian dollar is good news for the economy. So I'd say mission accomplished for the RBA.
While the Reserve Bank tries to keep the Australian dollar from rising too much, it's also got big problems to tackle at home. The RBA desperately wants to see shoppers spending in shopping centres and department stores around the country to help lift economic growth and, ultimately, workers' pay packets. But as HSBC's chief economist Paul Bloxham explains, that's still looking like a pipe dream.
Look, I think growth is very sluggish and we do need to be at a turning point. Growth needs to be picking up pace. There are some signs of that in things like the housing market, and the labour market's still holding together quite well, but we have yet to see very much of a lift in the consumer. So hopefully today's cuts will deliver a bit more support in that space. The question is, even if we're at a gentle turning point, is that enough to get inflation to go back to target eventually? And we might need just a bit more than a gentle turning point. We might need a stronger lift in growth. And that's precisely why the RBA is in all likelihood delivered its cut today.
To date, China's insatiable appetite for Australia's raw materials has driven much of the country's fortunes, including a potential return to surplus. Indeed, China's ambassador to Australia today reminded Canberra about just how dependent Australia is on the global superpower. Chen Zhenji told the Australian newspaper, China's growth and the cooperation between China and Australia in trade, economic and other areas is a major factor in our growth. HSBC's Paul Bloxham agrees Australia is highly dependent on China.
Australia is a medium-sized open economy, highly dependent on what happens offshore, and our major trading partner, our single largest trading partner, is China. Of course, what happens in terms of China's growth, particularly onshore China, is going to drive a lot of the story for Australia's growth story. And if you look at what we export, a lot of what we export is commodities, a lot of that's sold to China, a lot of what we export in terms of services is also sold to China. So we're highly dependent on what happens both offshore, but particularly what happens in the Chinese economy.
So where to from here? Well, the Coalition isn't committing to additional government spending over and above the $100 billion already slated, so further immediate stimulus needs to come from lower interest rates. Of course, today's cash rate cut means little without the big four banks passing it on, which led to this comment from Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
It is the government's expectation that the banks will pass on this 25 basis point rate cut in full.
Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers then put in his 2 cents.
Well, rates are coming down in Australia because the government doesn't have a plan to turn around an economy which is floundering on their watch.
It's completely reckless for the Labor Party to be talking down the Australian economy.
Beverly Morris from the Queensland Investment Corporation spends her days working out where Australia's economic policy is heading. She says it all depends on how willing the commercial banks are to pass on the cut.
At some point, if the banks feel that they cannot pass this on any further, that will sort of indicate that, at least in terms of the cash rate moves, that it may be reaching a floor.
Is quantitative easing next? At that point?
Yes, and that's exactly right. At that point, the RBA will need to, go down a different path and try alternative methods of trying to stimulate the economy. And there's no question that even at this point, that debate will be hotting up very seriously within the RBA, you'd think.
Beverly Morris from Queensland Investment Corporation, David Taylor with that report. And that is PM for today. I'm Linda Mottram. You can find us on the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts as well. And do subscribe while you're there and leave a review. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Modern China is turning 70 and marking the occasion with a massive display of national might.
It's one of the most nationalistic countries on earth, but it's taken a lot of work to make it that way.
So how did the Chinese people end up loving their country as much as they do? And is everyone really on board, or are they just afraid to step out of line?
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.